Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 14th. I'm Ray Graff. Astronomer Bob Berman has returned to Studio A to answer your astronomy questions. Bob's new book is Earth-Shattering, Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, Biological Mayhem, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Hazards to Life in Our Universe. It's a brand new book. We'll talk about that and any question you have, maybe about Pluto, Mercury, Mars, whatever. Give us a call right now, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. The world-famous famous astronomer Bob Berman is here, and he's got a new book, and it's exciting, and we'll talk about that and your questions on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff, renowned astronomer Bob Berman, back in Studio A to ponder all of your astronomy-related questions. Bob's new book is Earth-Shattering, Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, Biological Mayhem, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Hazards to Life in Our Universe. It is, I believe, on Little Brown, correct? And it's a great new book. We'll talk about that coming up. If you have a question for Bob about anything under the sun or even beyond, 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551 is the number, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman, how are you?
Great. Well, a little tired, just back from Alaska. For a long trip coming back, but good. Great to be back
here.
So
you just got back today?
The night before last.
And it takes a little while to get used to
really does.
All the time changes and such. And I assume you saw some aurora?
This was cloudier than usual. Usually our groups see a few, but fortunately we caught a good one the very final night.
Oh, lucky
people
you.
People there in Central Alaska think the climate is getting warmer and cloudier. Over time. So if true, that's not good.
The new book, Earth Shattering, is, well, you just got done with the book show. You taped a book show with Joe Donahue just now,
right.
That's exciting. So that'll be on in coming weeks. This book is great. If you're not a worry wart, this is a great book. But there's a lot of stuff to worry about in this book.
I don't know why I'm laughing. It's not the appropriate response to a book about cataclysms, but...
But you had a funny or an interesting point here before the show started, and you said the ones that people get really worked up about are the ones that aren't quite as dire.
Oh, it's true. And one of the things near the end of the book, I looked at the end of the world hysterias. What's the plural of hysteria?
I don't know.
Going back in time. And found an interesting pattern that seems to repeat. Usually there is an actual astronomy event, like a lineup of planets or a return of Halley's Comet.
Right.
And then what happens is someone puts out an article, or these days it would be a blog or something like that, claiming that there are Bible verses or Nostradamus quatrains or other or things written from ancient civilizations that foresaw this coming astronomical event and that it means the end of the world. So it's a tie-in of an actual astronomy event, usually like a close visit from a comet or an asteroid, plus the claim that it was prophesized in olden days. And it's the combination of the two that produces the mass media workup of the people and then creates things like that 2012 end of days, supposedly that was prophesized by the Mayans, or the 1982 Jupiter effect where all the planets were supposedly
going to line up.
Right, which is going to cause California to have such earthquakes it was going to break into the
sea. I remember that.
On the other hand, sometimes you get those like Halley's Comet in 1910 that was a caused by cyanide, because there's cyanogen in comet tails, and it was going to supposedly sweep so close to Earth that it was going to poison Earth's atmosphere and destroy all life. So there at least there was a faint science backup to the hysteria. And perhaps the most famous, in 1833, a unbelievable meteor shower was seen in the South. and especially on plantations where the slaves at that time saw 60 meteors per second. Now, you have to picture what that would have been like in
the sky.
That's
a storm, right?
Yes, exactly. It's a meteor storm, and it lasted for hours. 60 a second where the sky was just, everybody assumed it was the end of the world. And it was the inspiration for the later song, Stars Fell on Alabama, was caused by that event. And so there's an actual thing that looks like Armageddon. And so it's usually an astronomy event like that that causes it. So there are coming ones in the next century. And I can, so I, in one chapter, gave the dates, and I'm quite confident that these are going to be real end of the world hysterias coming up.
Oh, when's the nearest one?
The nearest one comes next year.
No way.
Yes, next
year. Oh, great.
Because, and you're going to like this, on the day of the winter solstice, December 21st of 2020, next year, the closest planetary conjunction of our lives is going to happen. And what I'm talking about is anyone with a backyard telescope will see Jupiter and Saturn in the same field of view.
Oh.
And when you look in the sky, those two planets are going to merge into a single star.
Ooh.
Or at least for those who skipped their last eye exam.
Prior to LASIK.
Yeah, they're going to be pretty close anyway. Even though, it's going to be almost a single star, even people with sharp vision. So that's going to be the next.
And what would be the pseudo-scientific basis to say, well, this is the end?
What will happen, this is, watch this. The fact that this is happening on the winter solstice, just like that Mayan calendar thing, somebody's going to come up with a supposed Nostradamus quatrain that prophesized it and that it was supposed to mean the end of the world, or biblical verses or something like that, and combined with that, that there is an actual event and then a supposed prediction in ancient times that this was going to foretell the end of the world.
Yeah.
That's what's going to throw it over the edge. We're going to have a real one in 2029 when the asteroid Apophis comes so close to Earth that it's going to be passing as close as our Earth satellites. It's going to pass so close that you're going to be able to see this asteroid cross the sky just with the naked eye.
Wow.
It's going to move, and nothing move. Even the moon, as close as it is, doesn't seem to move against the background stars. It takes a whole hour to move its diameter against the background stars. Not that time.
So that's 10 years from now.
That's 10 years from now. And then we're going to have, even before that, in 2027, the longest total solar eclipse for the rest of the century is going to happen over the Holy Land.
Ah.
So darkness over the Holy Land, over the Nile in Egypt. Are you kidding? You can count on that one. So things like that.
I mean, one of these times, the just by coincidence, it'll be correct, yeah?
Well, or something bad will happen, earthquakes, and then we'll never hear the end of it after that.
Bob Berman is our guest. The new book is Earth-Shattering, Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, Biological Mayhem, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Hazards to Life in Our Universe. Our number here on Vox Pop is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. Let's jump on the phones and take a call here. Mel and Willow. Mel, you're on.
Oh, hi. My question concerns the mechanism of star formation. Exactly how does a star become a star? I know it's originally just a sphere that develops from the gas of a nebula, and then somehow it develops this engine in the core in which hydrogen atoms are transformed into helium atoms, and that's the basic mechanism of a star's existence. And how exactly does that happen?
Well, you pretty much nailed it right there. Your explanation was as good as mine. You just have to make sure you have enough substance, and it's always hydrogen, in the gas cloud so that it can have a glob of separate gas that self-contracts from its own gravity. And then once it starts contracting, the smaller it gets, the greater is the gravitational pull at the surface. And so that makes it contract further and further. Gravitational attraction always translates into heat. And eventually you reach the temperature needed to create this tiny core. It's a very tiny nuclear furnace in our sun. If you could see the core, which is the only place that power is being generated, it would look only like a star. The sun has size to it, but the core is a dot. that if the rest of the sun weren't there, it would only look star-like, even though it's creating, believe it or not, the same energy as 96 billion one-megaton H-bomb blasts per second. That's what the core creates. And in every star—
And that's a very tiny core.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The core is only about 1/200th the volume of the sun. It's the cores are very tiny, but that's what you need. That's essentially the gestalt of the star. That's the heart and soul of the star.
Mel, thanks for the call. Now, you have mentioned in programs past, particularly when we were talking about your book, The Sun's Heartbeat, that the temperatures on the outer parts of the sun are actually much hotter than they are on the inside. Why is that?
Well, it depends upon how far outside and inside you're talking about. The core has the greatest temperature, no question. But the photosphere, which is the layer that we see, the outer surface, the so-called surface, it's a gaseous surface, is only 11,000 degrees compared to the tens of millions of degrees of the core. But then outside of that, its so-called atmosphere, the corona.
Yeah.
Then it gets hot again. And it goes back up into the millions of degrees
again.
And why
is that?
And that was one of the biggest mysteries in astronomy until recently. And it still is mysterious because we don't know the exact mechanism. But it seems to be magnetic fields that are whose lines are connecting and then disconnecting are producing the heat that makes the corona so hot. But that surface, it's interesting when you can actually see the sun. You know, sometimes it's behind just the right kind of cloud where you can see it. Its disk very clearly. And then people marvel that why should the sun be such a sharp-edged disk when it's made of gas? Shouldn't it be a blurry kind of thing if it's gaseous? And the reason is that that layer that actually radiates the heat from the core way inside of it is so thin, it's almost painted on. Huh. It's only 200 miles thick, that photosphere, the part that actually glows. So it's so thin, it's this painted-on layer that no wonder it looks sharp, that its edge looks so sharp.
Bob Berman is our guest. We'll take a quick break here. 800-348-2551 is the number on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551, and we'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Bob Berman is our guest today. The number is 800-348-2551. And Bob, two emails here, and then we'll get back to the phones. This one's from Nancy in Queensbury. Nancy wants to know, what is your favorite astronomical phenomenon?
Phenomenon or object?
Well, it says phenomenon.
Well, then, no question, it's a total solar eclipse. And
okay.
For that, you don't even need any optical aid. Total solar eclipse is the most mind-blowing phenomenon. Not a partial and not a total lunar. It has to be a total solar. It's also the rarest of them.
Okay. And this one is from James. And James writes, is it possible that all stars would eventually collapse and the universe would go completely dark?
Sure. Sure. It would seem inevitable because you've got to eventually use up the hydrogen that's around, and unless the expansion of the universe reverses itself and it collapses and everything starts anew, and then we have another, you know, I mean, it's the old Hindu legend of the breaths of Brahma with the universe oscillating in and out like giant breaths, maybe once every 80 billion years, maybe with new laws of physics each time. So, that could happen, and that would mean that it would keep going.
Is there any evidence that it could happen?
No, but we don't know what's causing the current increase in expansion. We call it dark energy, but there's no way to know whether that wouldn't reverse itself over time. So we really don't know.
Bob Berman is our guest on Vox Pop today. 800-348-2551, the number. David in Schenectady. David, you're on.
Hi. Let's say we have a Earth orbit, a satellite in elliptical Earth orbit, and the perigee is on the sunny side. Will that perigee always stay on the sunny side as the Earth rotates around the sun, or will it also rotate?
Yeah, most of them rotate. It's an interesting question. The Because as long as it's being pulled at by other forces, the gravitational forces of other objects which abound, then you can have the a progress either prograde or retrograde in the orbit. For example, the moon would be a good example. As the moon goes around, its apogee, perigee changes, and that's why we have something called the anomalistic month, which is not the same length of time it takes the moon to go around as relative to, let's say, the background stars as a grid, which is 27.32166 days, but actually moves around every 8.6 years. So you get that or time from perigee to the next perigee of 27.55455 days. I'm glad I remember. I was trying to remember. I was memorizing.
He has no laptop here, folks. It's all in his head.
Yeah. So that's what's happening with the moon, and so that's what orbits tend to do. Yes, quite right.
Okay. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Speaking of satellites, you had mentioned the on your list of potential cataclysmic events, or at least events that will cause hysteria, 2029. The asteroid is coming. What was the asteroid's name?
It's Apophis.
Apophis. And it's coming, you said, closer than the orbits of our satellites.
Yes, yes. It'll be as close as our, at least our geostationary satellites, up at 22,000 miles. Quite so. And it's going to come on Friday the 13th.
Wow.
If you need one extra thing for the end of the world, 13th of April that year.
Any chance it will take out some satellites?
There's a chance if it's that close. Nobody knows it precisely enough.
How big?
Imagine you're watching your favorite TV show and you figure that what's causing the problem.
Well, with our luck, it'll be the NPR satellite again. I seem to recall 20 years ago, the satellite just went off into space. I forget which satellite it was. There was operator error, and I think it went away. Was it a Galaxy 5? One of those. But how big is this asteroid that's coming?
Oh, it's only a few miles across, but
We won't feel gravitational effects of this.
No,
thing.
We won't, but it will. I mean, there's fears that when it next comes to Earth in 2036, I think it is, also in April of that year, it would have a small chance of hitting us, meaning chance one in 200,000, thanks to the change of its orbit caused by this first encounter.
And they can really predict it that accurately.
Yeah, but not accurately enough.
So it could hit us in 2029, theoretically.
Not in 2029. At first, there was fear of it, but no. But the next time around in 2036,
okay,
April of that year, there's a small chance.
Very interesting.
Which has been downgraded. First, it was a larger chance. But when more data comes in, the threat always gets downgraded. You know why?
Why?
It's a very interesting process. You know, whenever you hear it could hit us, and then later on they say, nah, nah, nah. You think, why is it always in that direction? Why is it always a downgrade? And the reason is simple, that when you first have information and it's a near miss, there's only one possible change that can cause it to collide with us, because it's a bullet hitting a bullet.
Right.
But there's thousands of different ways that it'll miss us by even more.
Mm.
And so with more data, there's a bias, a natural bias toward the threat being going away.
Do you think that the powers that be would even tell us if there was a good chance that it was a direct hit?
Well, I don't know about powers, but everybody would I don't know any astronomers that wouldn't blab it to their colleagues, to their friends, to their family.
Make a point, yeah.
Oh, it would get out. No, there would be no secret. And there are no ways to even keep a secret. When I was with Discover Magazine for I was in every issue for 17 years in Discover Magazine. We did an issue once on the spy satellites, the KH-11,
yeah,
and what their capability was. And we did research to find out exactly what they could see. Nobody from the government said, hey, you know what, this is, don't put this out there. Nah, the government really doesn't censor the news media.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest, and let's go to Bruce in Albany. Bruce.
Good afternoon, guys. Love your show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I have a question about the origin of water on Earth. I know that astronomers hypothesize that water came from, you know, asteroids colliding or meteors colliding asteroids. But is there any other explanation that would explain the amount of water we have here on Earth, such as biological processes or geological processes?
Well, the first thing we have to realize is that water is the most common compound in the entire universe.
How do you know that?
Well, first, it should be because it's made of hydrogen, the most common element by far, mixing with the next most common element that'll bond with anything. I mean, the next most common element is helium, but that's a loner. Helium doesn't combine with anything. The next most common element, third in the universe's list, is oxygen, which promiscuously will bond with anything, anytime. So, of course, you're going to get hydrogen and oxygen bonding. So, logically, there should be a lot of water. But then when we look around, we see water everywhere. The rings of Saturn are chunks of water ice. We're finding more and more moons that have oceans under their surfaces. For example, most notably Europa on Jupiter, Enceladus of Saturn. And since we're seeing water wherever, almost wherever we look, and logically there should be water because of the abundance of its constituents, of course there's going to be water. So now we get to the specifics. What was the mechanism on Earth? Now, remembering that it's there elsewhere in the solar system in great abundance, on the surface of Mars, under the surface on moons of Jupiter and Saturn. So it's not a stretch to say, well, Earth would have it too. What brought the water to these places? You know, so the water is there. Water is in the universe. But yes, it could have been. And one of the thoughts is that in the early Wild West years of the solar system, when we were constantly hit with asteroids and comets are mostly water ice. Hmm. And so an endless delivery system for water reaching us could have been from comets. Was it enough to account for all of it? I don't know, and I don't know if anybody knows.
Hmm.
One of the ways you find out is looking at the isotopic ratio of the oxygen that's part of water and seeing whether it's completely terrestrial or whether some of it has an alien origin.
Hmm. All right. Well, Bruce, thanks for the call. And of course, we have found that there is water ice in craters on the moon.
Yeah, that too.
Is that the same signature as the water we have here?
Strangely, it is. It's strange. It's one of the things that kind of puzzles us because nowadays, in fact, that was part of, we have a chapter on the birth of the moon because that was a cataclysm for Earth. It seems that the moon was caused by Earth colliding with a Mars-sized planet. The combination of the two created the moon. The thing is, if that's the case, then the oxygen on the moon shouldn't all look like earthly oxygen. The isotopes of oxygen should be alien. And let me explain. On Earth, we're all breathing in we're breathing in oxygen, of course. It's 20% of the air or so. But oxygen comes in three different types, depending upon how many neutrons are in each atom. Normally, you have 8 neutrons and 8 protons in most oxygen, and so we call that O16. But a little bit of the oxygen, one part in 500, has an extra neutron. So it has 8 protons. It has to have 8 protons, otherwise it wouldn't be oxygen, and 9 neutrons. And so 9, 8, or 17, so that's O17. And there's even a rarer form of oxygen that we breathe with every breath that's O18, that has 2 neutrons more than the most common. This ratio of the most common oxygen, O16, to O17 and O18, stays the same on Earth. It's in the air. It's in all our rocks. It's in all the silicon that's in all the it's all the silica that's in all the quartz and mm-hmm. all the sand on every beach. There's no part of Earth that has any different ratio than that O16 to 17 to 18 ratio everywhere on Earth. Mm. It's inviolable and never changes because it grew up with Earth. Now, here's the thing. When we get a meteor that crashes onto to Earth from somewhere else, we analyze its isotopic ratio, and we find that Mars has a lower ratio of O16 to 17, 18 than Earth does. The asteroid Vesta has a higher ratio.
Hmm.
And so the isotopic ratio is a fingerprint that tells us where space rocks came from. Now, all of this was just background. Take the moon. The moon should have a very different ratio, too. It doesn't. To within one part in 50,000, it has the same isotopic ratio as earthly rocks and earthly oxygen does. Why? No one can figure it out. It's almost as if it's Earth itself up there orbiting the moon.
Right.
It's so different. And so it's one of the things that drives astronomers crazy, especially if we're sure, and we're fairly sure, that the moon was born from a collision between us and another object. Where is that alien oxygen? We don't find it on the moon.
So clearly, there is a bit of the formation of the moon that is conjecture.
Yes, because of this.
Interesting. Bob Berman is our guest. Astronomy is the topic. 800-348-2551 is the number. Carl in Warwick. Carl, you're on.
Yeah, hey. All right, so just bear with me.
All right.
So you made an observation before that most of the universe is hydrogen. And if you take into account infinity, it seems as though you're making predictions based on a very small subset. And I'll give you an example. Let's say you're an ant, and you can only go a football field. That's your whole life is a football field. And you're on a big piece of paper that's a square mile, and it's red and flat. So to the ant and his observations, everything is flat and red, but in fact, it isn't.
Right. Yeah, well, we've talked about this before, that all of our knowledge of the universe, if the universe is in fact infinite, then what do we know? We know 0%?
Pretty much.
Yeah, and anyway, there's two universes, and so when we talk about the universe, I don't bother qualifying it because it sounds like adding extra words, but there is the visible universe, or sometimes called the observable universe. That's everything from here to 13.8 billion light years from here. That's where light can get here that we can analyze spectroscopically and determine things. But then there's the universe. This goes along with our caller's question, Carl, is that from that point on, and that might go on infinitely, we don't know. That's the vast bulk of the universe from that point on. We don't know a single thing about it. So whenever we're talking, we're assuming that the sample we have in front of us continues on to the rest of the universe. But you're quite right. That's an assumption. We don't know that for sure.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot, Carl. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, the guest, and Nathan is in New Paltz. Nathan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. So my question is, why does it not make sense for the moon to have the same makeup if it was just dust from a collision with Earth?
Okay, so the earthly part of its composition should have the same isotopic oxygen ratio as Earth does. Yes, you're right about that. But supposedly, we collided with another object, and it was the conglomeration of material from these two that coalesced to form the moon. So, and that was, calculations show, would have been a Mars-sized object. In other words, about half our diameter. So that should make up a sizable percentage of the moon's material. And so why isn't some of the oxygen on the moon showing a alien isotopic ratio? Why does it show a perfectly earthly? Well, I won't say perfectly. There's one part in 50,000 difference. So there's a slight, slight difference, but it's so slight that it puzzles everyone. We can't figure it out.
So there's just no evidence of the other object is what puzzles everyone.
Exactly.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Nathan. Well, let's take a break here. Bob Berman's new book is Earth-Shattering, Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, Biological Mayhem, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Hazards to Life in Our Universe. Our number here is 800-348-2551. We'll be right back. Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. Always fun to have Bob Berman in the house. Bob's new book is Earth Shattering, and then there's a long subtitle. We'll do that again at the end. A couple of emails here, Bob, and then we'll get back to the phones. By the way, there is one astronomical event you wanted to mention that's coming up.
Yeah, the equinox, and this year is one of those just a few times per century when the full moon and the equinox happen the same day. In fact, they happen within a few hours of each other. So that's kind of cool. That means sun and moon will be opposite each other. One will be sitting exactly in the west that afternoon, perfectly due west, where theoretically the moon should be rising due east, but it's not. I won't get into why. But anyway, they're opposite each other. Full moon on the equinox on the 20th.
Can you concoct any sort of end of the world scenario for that? Maybe we can get something cooking here. No? All right. Let's go to the emails. This one's from Diana in Albany. Diana writes, I read Bob's book, Beyond Biocentrism. I recall one chapter talking about time not being real, but rather a construct of human consciousness. If that is so, how then do we talk about the age of the universe and other things within it being older than the years that humans have been conscious?
Well, yes, and that gets a little tricky because would those things be there if we weren't observing them? In other words, without the human mind looking at the fossils and the fossil records, is there an external thing where time chugs along even if in our absence? And for a reason that, it, as you know, takes a whole chapter to explain, we say, no, there isn't. That except for as part of space-time, but that's a different definition of time that Einstein used as space-time. They're counted as sort of a dimension to define where things are. Time is not real except for as an aspect of human beings. In other words, we carry it around like turtles with shells. It's sort of an intimate part of how we perceive things.
All right. This one's from Bonnie, and Bonnie writes, heard on BBC this week, Earth experienced a 30X giant solar flare thousands of years before Christ. This was detected from ice cores from Antarctica. Can you explain the what and also the how that a trace of a flare appears in ancient ice?
Yes, because it causes ionization of substances that were on Earth, and these can be detected. And once there's ice gets buried, and then there's a long period of time before it moves up to the surface. This is why one of the members of our Alaska tour, in fact, last week, had just come back from Antarctica, and one of the things they're doing is harvesting meteorites for the same reason. A meteorite will fall on Earth. Generally, you know, you'll never find it. But in the Antarctic, it'll bury itself in the snow, eventually get pressured into ice. The ice has its own lifetime under the surface and can go 16,000 years, as the case with one famous meteorite, and then works its way to the surface. Huh. And researchers on snowmobiles suddenly seeing a black rock in the middle of nothing, of all that white where there shouldn't be a rock. That's the easiest way to find meteorites.
And is that not where they found the alleged meteorite that had the possible signature of Martian life?
That's right, ALH84001.
Whatever became of that?
That was that famous Alan Hills meteorite. Well, for a while that got all the headlines because looked at microscopically, it seemed to have traces, fossil traces of ancient bacteria in it. That was making us think that there was life on Mars. And for a little bit of time, we thought we actually had evidence for life on Mars. That's back when Dan Golden was the head of NASA. To his credit, he was open enough to actually have a press conference on that. It proved to be wrong, but just the fact that you would do that and take that kind of risk, that was great. Dan Golden was a good guy. I liked him.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Bob Berman, the guest, and Ruby is in Amherst. Ruby, you're on.
Hi. My question is about water in regards to Earth. Would it be a closed system or an open system?
Earth being a closed or an open system regarding water?
Yeah.
It's mostly closed, but we still get hit with meteors that have water in them. In fact, every meteor shower, every single one, the meteors you're seeing are bits of comets. And so every meteor shower, like the famous Perseids every year on August 11th and 12th, the Leonids on in the middle, well, we're not going to have the Leonids again until the end of this century, the Geminids on December 13th and 14th, all of them are caused by impacts from bits of comets. And so they're all mostly water.
Yeah.
And so they're all still delivering water to the Earth, to the atmosphere that eventually ends up at the surface.
How much a year?
So, you know, I've seen figures that range from 1 ton to thousands of tons a year. If you look it up, you'll see it's all over the place, those estimates, which shows that nobody really knows. So that's still, you know, we're still being fed.
Well, thank you for the call. And I assume then that the water that is in the very dark places of the moon where the sun doesn't hit. In other words, the bottom of craters, there is ice. And that is also from strikes, meteor strikes?
Yes, yes. I believe that all of them, because the rest of the moon is anhydrous. One of the things that we learned from it is that there's not even any compounds of that contain water on the moon. So all of them are believed to be from comet impacts. And they wouldn't survive the sunlight if it weren't for the fact that the moon's tilt relative to the sun is so up and down that at the poles, sunlight comes horizontally. And so you get a depression at either pole, and sunlight doesn't get down into the crater.
Right.
And so the bottom of the craters are forever dark, like a vampire's lair. And so that's where you can keep ice, and that's where we'll harvest it someday if we ever have a colony on the moon.
Fair enough. Bob Berman, our guest. Our number is 800-348-2551. Astronomy Today on Vox Pop. Let's go over to Leo in Greenfield. Leo, you're on.
Yes, Greenfield Center. Bob Berman, I love it when you're on and can hardly wait.
Thank
you. This question is about for years now, I've looked at the sun and watched the sunspots go by, and of the last couple of years or so, there's been no solar activity, no sunspots. And would this have an effect on the amount of radiation we get from the sun?
Sure. And that's great that you're doing that. It's true, the sunspot cycle has been strange, and one of the things that have made it strange is that the current sunspot cycle, Carrington cycle number 24, has had a quicker minimum. The graphs, even from a couple of years ago, show the expected graphs that are years from now before we reach minimum. Instead, we've been at rock bottom. There hasn't been a spot on the sun now for I think something like 6 weeks, not even one little sunspot.
Yeah.
So you're absolutely right. The sun is really, really quiet. Does it have an effect on the energy reaching Earth? Yes, but not as much as one might think. The average solar insolation is 1,365 watts per square meter of Earth's surface. That's how much energy is delivered by the sun, 1,365 watts. At the time of sunspot maximum, that can go up to 1,367 from 1,365. So you wouldn't write home about it. It's not like a huge change, but it is a change. But the change is greater in the ultraviolet, even though only a few percent of the energy from the sun is ultraviolet. After all, the sun's energy that it puts out is about 50-50 visible light and infrared, what we think of as heat.
Right.
But still, there's a few percent ultraviolet also. And that can vary by 15%.
Do we know why?
In the sunspot cycle. Well, it's the most energetic thing that's being given off by the photosphere. So that's the thing that's closer to what we're getting right from the core. Without it has had fewer layers of atomic absorption and then re-radiation. And so that, we think, still kind of mysterious, may have different stages of changing our atmosphere, which then could change maybe the climate a little bit. And so there are intermediate steps that may be more decisive in producing the effects when the sun is weak. Of course, the famous one was the Maunder minimum from 1645 to 1715, when the whole cycle stopped and the sun's radiation got lower and the Earth got cold. We're talking about
the canals of Venice freezing and fishing colonies in Iceland and Greenland having to be abandoned and icebergs and the Thames being frozen over that nobody had ever seen before and stuff like that. Could that happen again because of a reduced radiation, especially now that the sun has been acting so strangely for a while and we're talking about it for at least the last 15 years? Yes, some solar researchers think maybe we are on the cusp. They think we are beginning a extended cycle of solar inactivity. Will it go as far as the Maunder minimum and be that kind of cold effect on Earth? We could hope so. That could be coming to our aid with the climate change. Could be the best possible time for that to happen, if that's happening. But we'll have to wait and see.
Now, you mentioned it's been about 6 weeks since there has been a sunspot on the sun. Explain to us, in layman's terms, what a sunspot actually is.
Well, it's a storm, because the sun's activity seems to be mediated by a magnetic field that originates in a layer called the tachocline, which is about 70% of the way from the center towards the edge. And there's where the field is created, and that dictates how material under the sun's surface will act. Now, as stuff tries to come up to the surface, material tries to rise, there are local areas where the magnetic field is 5,000 times stronger than the rest of the surface. And that acts to choke or constrict the ability of material to rise up. And so, because it's taking longer, it cools off a bit. And that's why it looks black. If you could take a black sunspot from the sun and put it out against the night sky, it would be so bright you couldn't even look at it.
Right.
So it's still very bright, but it looks black compared to the rest of the sun.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what a sunspot is. And sometimes coming from the sunspot, because of that intense magnetic field, you also get release of either energy or even particles. You could get flares coming from that, coronal mass ejections, CMEs, they're called, that can throw as much as 10 billion tons of solar material in our direction so fast that it gets here in just a few days.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551 if you want to get a call in here in the waning moments. You mentioned the sun for 15 years or so has been acting strangely. And to hear a scientist say strangely makes those of us who aren't scientists say, my gosh, what do they really know? Maybe this is it for the sun and it's on the way out.
Well, it's not on the way out.
How do you know?
Because the sun has plenty of hydrogen left. It's vigorous in its energy production. And all the solar experts say it'll be 1.1 billion years before something significantly changes in the sun that's going to make Earth toast. We've got a 1.1 billion years
left. And that's when the sun increases in luminosity?
Yeah. Well, the sun is always increasing in luminosity by 10% every billion years.
Right.
But the next billion, in other words, the next 10% uptick in the sun's brightness is something that Earth cannot compensate for. I mean, the experts in this, and I'm not one of them, have said that in the past, the sun was only half as bright as it is now when the Earth was young. So we've had a 10% rise every billion years. We're now 4.5 billion years old. So we've had a 45%, almost 50% increase in the sun's brightness since Earth was young.
So 2 billion years ago, Venus would have been a different place.
Because it wouldn't have been as quite as hot.
Right. Presumably the runaway greenhouse effect would not have begun.
Maybe. I don't know, because it has so much CO2 on Venus, so much carbon dioxide that has this heat-trapping ability, and that's been there probably all along. So I don't know if Venus would have escaped, to what degree it would have escaped that.
All right, let's quickly go to Ed in Port Ewan. Ed, you're on with Bob Berman.
Oh, hi. First, I want to thank Mr. Berman. I've been listening on WAMC for many years. I have two young boys, and these are big topics for us at home. And your crystal clear articulations are really, really wonderful, and how you cross-reference and kind of fill out the material. My question is there any source for your talks online?
Well, I mean, Vox Pop, every time he's on, we have an audio file for that. Strange Universe is online at WAMC.org, and that's, I'm sure you've heard that, but that is what we call a module. It's a couple of minutes long, right, Bob?
That's right. Every Sunday morning at 9:35.
Something like that. But it's also online at WAMC.org, as right. is this program. Right. And
But thank you for your kind words. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Ed. Quickly over to Karen in Amherst. Karen.
Hi. You were talking earlier about the equinox and the full moon coinciding.
Yes.
And we were always taught that Easter was the first Sunday after the first full moon, after the vernal equinox. So how is that being calculated this year?
Okay. Well, I understand that the church does this. And what they do is if there is an actual coincidence of the full moon and the vernal equinox, which is what happens, they may use a particular date. For example, for a long time, as you may know, the vernal equinox was March 21st.
Right.
It's been slowly changing thanks to the 400-year nature of our calendar, so that it just in our own lifetimes, well, I won't put you in my geriatric class, but in my own lifetime anyway, and Ray's, I'll throw him
That's
in
fine.
My group, it has gone from March 21st to March 20th. I believe that the church figures that they still use March 21st. So that being the case, if that's their date for the equinox, but the moon, full moon, is on the 20th, that will force them to use the next full moon to calculate Easter, in which case we're going to have a very late Easter this year. So that's what they
very
do.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
That's great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks, Karen. All right. We only have, we only have a minute. Do we have enough time to take another call?
I'll do it.
All right. Well, I think we lost him. Don't know? I think we're almost done. Oh, we do have we have Tim in Boston Spa. Tim, you have about 30 seconds.
Oh, just one little congratulatory thing. I've always wondered why, or I had an epiphany as to why this program is always so interesting, and that is because the universe is infinitely interesting, and there's just no end to what Bob can talk about.
Genius. Well, yeah. I couldn't have said it better myself, although I wouldn't have.
Yeah, thanks for that. And it might be infinite. We're it's still being debated. I spoke to a cosmologist a few years ago about whether the part of the universe we cannot see might be infinite, because that big study at Berkeley a few years ago of 900,000 galaxies showed that space has a flat topology
yes.
from here to where we can stop seeing it, where everything expands at the speed of light. So with a flat topology, it shows that it could be infinite. That has not been ruled out now. So, but is it? It's very cool. It's only our lifetimes that we know that this has a scientific basis for the possibility of an infinite universe.
Bob Berman's new book is Earth-Shattering, Violent Supernovas, Galactic Explosions, Biological Mayhem, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Hazards to Life in Our Universe. It's on Little Brown. Always great to have Bob here. Support comes from Paul Smith's College, the College of the Adirondacks, offering degrees in management, natural sciences, hospitality, forestry, psychology, and more. Paul Smith's College, it's about the experience. paulsmiths.edu. Colby Attorney Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing and corporate record searches, colbyservice.com. Berkshire Center for Weight Loss Surgery, with a patient-centered focus on long-term life skills and health with weight loss surgery. Monthly seminars open to the public, 413-395-7510 to register. And Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, offering lawn and garden equipment, parts, and service to customers throughout Western Massachusetts. A family-owned business for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here today. Thank you for listening and for the calls. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Your phones were answered by Amber Sickles. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, the team from Katie O'Byrne's Irish Pub is here for Food Friday. It's St. Patrick's Day edition. Right now, stand by for news.